Okay. Good morning. I wish your mouth was not sort of like which team, but I'm sure he'll be here shortly.
Great. You missed a great time.
So we left off on the Gemara and Daf Chasalad of an Aleph. About 8 lines down or so from when they get wide. A few words in it, the two dots. So this, the Gemara says the following. I will do my best to translate only because certain anatomical aspects are, or positions are a little bit difficult to describe here. One of the things that I have noticed is that in the translations, I haven't looked at, I don't have an art scroll, so I didn't, I don't know whether you have the art scroll handles translation here. But before the Santino Talmud was published, probably 70, 80 years ago, however long ago it was published, so there was actually a Talmudic edition. I don't know if it was a full translation. I don't know. I got it years ago on the web. I think Rodkinson was the name. I don't know if that's probably not familiar to anybody. I don't know if they finished the edition at all. But I noticed that when I would look at certain passages, I would use them mostly for adult education. I wanted translations before I found that Santino was already out of copyright and it was available online. So I would look at some of the passages in the Gemara, and the censoring of language of anything that related to the sexual was like, it was stunning. It was like, I would say it was a total distortion, in fact, of what was going on.
What year was it written?
I think it was in the 19s, or something like that. Very early, first decade or two of the early 20th century. The idea that you couldn't actually write such a thing. But we know when you look in the Santino, I don't know what art school is like. You look in the Santino, and there is still a degree, I wouldn't say it's distortive, but it makes it actually hard to understand, because again, there's a certain amount of euphemism and sort of, I would say, covering up. And while we do value tznius, it certainly is a very important value, we don't value tznius at the expense of obfuscating exactly what's being said.
In an art scroll, I find very often this skirming around.
So, Chazal, we're not shy about this. I'm not going to, go through various kinds of sources where Chazal were, I would say, quite graphic, maybe not by 21st century standards, but clearly by Victorian standards. But Chazal were not shy about that. When you're describing humanity, describing position, so they were very forward about that. Some of Chazal's views or some of the descriptions might be, I don't know, off-putting, might be a little, some off-putting in certain contexts, especially with regards to women. But nonetheless, I think in translating Gemara, you have to translate honestly and clearly as best as one can.
What does Safari have? They have Santino?
No,
they have Steinbach. They have the Ikor and Steinbach. They have Steinbach. They don't hide anything.
So,
but I find gross errors in Steinbach.
Okay. Anyway, I say that as I'm going to do my best, because there's certain couple things that are a little bit unclear.
I have your touch with them.
So the Gemara says the following: Amar Mar, again, 8 lines down from when they get wide. Amar Mar, Zemach Zirpana Bekori Kriyashma. So the Braisa had stated earlier, talking about two individuals, and the Gemara had a discussion: were these two individuals husband and wife, or were these two individuals two members, presumably of the same sex, but not husband and wife, sleeping, sharing a bed, and it makes, that sounds totally strange to us. People might have to do that, like high school students in a hotel room when they go somewhere. You might very well have such images. Of course, I think we would tell our students that you need to be wearing pajamas when you sleep under the circumstances. But as the Rishonim comments here, this was typical in the time of the Gemara. People did not sleep in any clothing. People, generally speaking, underwear didn't exist then. There's a fairly recent innovation. So when people went to sleep, they slept under a sheet or under a blanket, and they weren't wearing any clothing. So the Braisa had said that when one wants to read Kriyat Shema, they should both be facing opposite directions. And in this way, their genitalia would not be coming in contact with one another, and that, therefore, would not constitute a problem. So now the Gemara says the following. The buttocks are touching one another. So we wouldn't say, it occupies something of a different sense than genitalia, but nonetheless, it would be considered something that is, I guess, usually covered or more sensitive. So the Gemara says, "Misayei l'Rafuna that Marfuna agavos ein bahem mishum erva," that the buttocks actually do not constitute erva. Now, for what purposes other than this? So one of the things we're going to see, and we've seen already, is that while there may be a problem of there's a when we talk about reading Kriya Shema or engaging in any Dvarim Shebekdusha, anything, davening and things like that in the presence when someone sees something that is considered erva in front of them. So one of the things that we will see, and it's not always, it can go, I would say, both directions. Men have erva as well, but there are greater concerns of a man seeing a woman unclothed. In terms of reading Kriya Shema, we're going to see a little bit later. Plus, one thing that's clear is that an individual who's alone by him or herself, as long as their what we call their erva, their genitalia are covered, then for the most part there's no problem. Let's say making a brach. Let me keep it simple. Kriya Shema and davening might be more complicated, but there's no prohibition of making a bracha. And the same thing is true if you have members of the same sex together. As long as the erva, as long as the genitalia are covered, it doesn't really matter whatever else is showing. You can, let's say, make brachos. There will be an issue if a man sees a woman and part of her body is uncovered that normally would be covered. That's a sort of a separate issue. But when it comes to being with oneself or when things are covered up, generally speaking, only something that is what I'll call objective erva. Maybe a better way of framing it is the following. From a halachic perspective, there's only one thing that's considered objective erva, regardless of societies. I don't know if there's been a human society in which it hasn't been considered erva, which is the genitalia, right? Both for men and women. That has generally always, that is halachically a category that's accepted. That's objective. Any other part of the body that would normally be covered, that is covered in a particular society, would be considered erva in that society. In another society in which we're not typically covered, it would not be considered erva. So if you were to, and I think that would objectively speak, that the halacha just does that, use that word, that would technically apply to really any part of the body outside of what we call, I'll call the makom ha'erva, the genitalia. So for example, one of the things we're going to see later is that, according to the Gemara, married women are supposed, women are supposed to cover their hair. It only comes up in the context of married women, that's a big dispute. However, we will see the machlokes, but the position of the Aruch HaShulchan and the position of Rav Moshe Feinstein was that today, when it is extremely common for married women to not cover their hair, there is no it's not erva. There might be an obligation. There might still be a din. You're required to cover your hair, a married woman, but it's not erva anymore. And therefore, even though we're going to see in the Gemara that one cannot read Kriya Shema when another woman, including his wife's hair, is uncovered in his presence that he can see it. That would not apply today, according to Ramoshan, according to the Aruch HaShulchan, because today it's perfectly normal for married women to not cover their hair. Even if it's not permitted. Even if it's not permitted, it's still not considered an erva anymore. Why? Because erva is, some erva, most erva, with the exception of the private parts, is considered subjective. It depends upon that society. I imagine, I don't think the post-Gemara are going to talk about this question, but supposing one lived, in certain societies, I don't think there are any Jews reading Kriya Shema there, but if you lived in certain parts of Africa where most people would go topless, men and women, it probably wouldn't be considered erva in that context. That's not the reality of our world and anywhere probably where any Orthodox Jew lives, but that would be considered, that's subjective erva. So, the Gemara here is when it talks about agavos, ein b'hem mishum erva, the varas don't constitute erva, that means it doesn't constitute objective erva. In this context, remember, you can't even see anything. You can't see anything. You're covered over by a sheet. But the concern is that people are touching each other back to back. So Rav Huna says that that's not, that halachically speaking, agavos themselves are not considered erva. So now the Gemara makes a suggestion. Lema misayeh alein Rav Huna. A woman can sit if she's not wearing any clothing and she's going to separate challah from the dough and she's going to make a bracha even though she's not wearing any clothing. Why? Paneha is a euphemism here. It doesn't mean her face. Chazal will use the term both by men and women. They'll use the expression by men, zakin shamala and zakin shamata. the beard above and the beard below, and beard above refers to the facial beard, the beard below refers to pubic hair. And in the context of paneha, they'll use the same thing with regards to woman, the paneha, the face above, and then they use paneha shalmata, because they are, it's not that they never engage in euphemism, but nonetheless, so that's what the term means. So the Braisa says, that she holal chasas paneh b'karka. What it means, avaloha ish, but a man can't do that. Why? Because the assumption is that a woman can be sitting, and it's not clear what position they have in mind here. It might be that she's kneeling on the ground or crouching. Maybe it's like, you know, if you sit on your knees. If you sit on your knees on the ground, so a woman's private parts will be mostly covered up, and therefore she's allowed to make a bracha. A man, that's not the case because they protrude. And therefore, a woman in such a situation could separate challah is not the problem, but making the bracha, a man cannot separate the challah because you're supposed to make a bracha when you separate the challah, and therefore, if you can't make a bracha under those circumstances, you're not doing the mitzvah properly. You should wait until you can do the mitzvah properly. So I think the Gemara's assumption here is that the woman is sitting on the ground, sort of on her knees, bent, you know, on her knees, and therefore, her genitalia are covered, but her buttocks are showing. And if she's allowed to separate challah now and make the bracha, that would suggest that Rav Huna is correct that adavos don't have erva. And the answer is no. It's not a proof, says the Gemara. Tirgama Rav Nachman Bar Yitzchak kigom shahayu paneha tochos v'karka. It says, I cannot find, I didn't check what art school was, I'd be curious. Fantina was totally, pretty much useless here. Or they're certainly not clear. What the Gemara is describing, the answer is that somehow a situation, and I think I know what it is, in which a woman is sitting where neither her genitalia nor her buttocks are showing. I think you'd have to probably be sitting on a chair and with her legs together. I'm guessing that that's the scenario, but the Gemara is trying literally the word paneha, which I assume means paneha shalmata. Tochos is a term that's usually used to mean to be attached to or to be stuck to. A tiach is something that lets you smear on a wall. So it means something that is very closely attached to the ground. So I don't know exactly what this position is. That's why I was hoping the translations would help me. But somehow they envision a scenario where all is covered up, and therefore you cannot prove that Rav Huna is correct when he says, Agavos ein bohem nishum erva. Obviously, this braisa seems to assume that it's certainly not an erva for contact purposes. One could distinguish between visually and simply touching one another. But the Gemara, if I'm not mistaken, in Shulchan Aruch, it's a suffix, whether or not agabos have the status of erva.
So is this an independent principle of libo roes erva?
That's a total, so libo roes erva, which let me explain what that term is. We're going to encounter it again, probably not today, but on the next page. Libo roes erva, would be a situation where you're wearing, let's say, a cloak, a robe, and underneath there's nothing that really separates between the heart and between the genitalia. So, in effect, the heart can see down. I know the heart doesn't see. And that libo roes erva is a dispute whether or not you can read, whether or not you can even read Kriya Shema that way.
So there's another principle on top.
Correct. In other words, there's erva a man seeing a woman. There's erva any individual seeing themselves or another person, even of the same sex. There's erva of physical contact, you know, and then there's erva internally within one's body, even though you can't see anything, even though it's covered, which we mentioned last time. That's why people once had time had the minhag to wear a garto, because a garto would serve as a separator. Okay. Fine. So now the Gemara continues. Amar Mar.
You're wearing underwear.
So if you're wearing underwear, then pretty much every issue disappears. I would say the following, leaving aside the question of head covering for brachas. Let's assume our minhag is to do so. But if a person who's wearing underwear, reciting brachos or Kriya Shema alone, man or woman, this certainly is not going to be a problem. Tefila requires a head covering of the top of your body as well. But for satisfying the issue of libo roes erva and covering the erva, so a person wearing underwear alone, man or woman, is sufficient for brachos and reading Kriya Shema.
So personally. If I put on my sewing and it's like a nice day and I have shorts on and I go outside with no shirt, that's not kosher to daven.
Speaking like you cannot daven, yes. Yeah. I should state something sort of as a general principle, which is, and I think there's a big difference between brachos here versus kriya shema and tefillah, which is many of these things are technically what is okay, right? There are things that, in other words, when you're davening, I'm not going to, you know, I don't know what KJ's policies on shorts are, and obviously there's, Rabbi Lichtstein didn't say anything, but there's a shaking of the head.
There's a lot.
He didn't verbally say anything. There is, you know.
He has in the past, though.
What's that?
He has in the past, I'm just saying.
Okay.
And others have said it also. So.
Because we're all guilty, most of us, not all of us, probably not Rabbi Lichtstein, certainly not here. We're all guilty on some level of not dressing appropriately for davening. What I mean by that is that the Gemara says in Shabbos, "Hiko l'kras elokach Yisrael." So not all of us put on our suit to daven. We can talk about varying degrees. You know, how much, you know, in yeshiva, so the guys put on their jackets and their hats, right? Now, would you really go to a formal affair dressed like that? Well, probably not without a tie. No, you wouldn't. I mean, in the Beis Medrash, they never wear a tie. So there's a question of appropriate attire when going to stand before one's maker. Obviously, there's a degree of subjectivity, right? In Israeli society, where virtually no one wears ties and jackets, nobody, I think, is going to say, you know, I'm pretty sure when you go to most yeshivas, certainly Hefei yeshivas, so I'm sure Luchtenstein Zichron Obracha wore a tie and jacket. I'm sure his children do not there. I could be wrong. I don't over-measure that. So they'll not
have he wore a hat, too.
Correct. So I think most people, even becoming the Chachamim, don't assume that, you should be dressed appropriately. It is probably the case, sorry for taking a stand here, but, you know, probably wearing shorts during davening isn't optimal. Is it technically usher? Maybe not. But not having one top covered is one cannot daven that way. I think the discussion that takes place here in Kriya Shema is really in the function of people who are in bed already. And therefore that is kind of the norm of that particular situation. I don't think anybody here who was talking about Kriya Shema was talking about Kriya Shema Shachas. And I think that just wouldn't have been.
How societally dependent is that? Something that I always thought about is maybe on a golf course, it's appropriate to daven, you know, daven with the polo shirt and shorts, and that's how people dress on a golf course, you know?
It's very, very, very hard to figure out, you know, what is, you know, is there some type of minimum standard? It's hard to answer that question, but would anybody, again, I could always say to you, you know, would you go greet the President of the United States that
because
way?
Because you're playing golf
with the President. The U.S. volleyball team apparently went to the White House. My wife thought this was a scandal. It's in flip-flops. Okay? So, you know, we become more and more informal as a society. I think the halacha sets some absolute bottom lines. I think incumbent upon, and I think the Tzibur, in its context, certainly the successes, sets what it thinks are appropriate standards and should. Every individual has a responsibility of sort of thinking and taking issues seriously, and not every individual will come to the exact same conclusion.
And what about the level for Shliach Tzibur being or above that?
I think the Shliach Tzibur has to be, you know, has to represent the Tzibur. So even if one were tolerant of lesser standards of people, it would be seemingly unfair to the people, you know, who do dress more appropriately. I'll put the adjective in there. During davening, if they have the shliach tzibur who doesn't in effect represent. I mean, there are a lot of shuls. I know my shul would be like this, where nobody, someone walks into shorts, you know, in congregation, we're not in Israel, there will probably be a few eyebrows raised. Maybe. But you can't go to the Ummah, you know, if you're not wearing shoes and you're not wearing, you know, I think even our shul's expectation is you're wearing socks. I think in Israel, that would obviously be very different when people walk around in sandals. And you're wearing at least short sleeves and you're wearing long pants. Right? That's a kind of a minimum. That's expected. So I think there's a very reasonable who's some Shliach Tzibur who is representing the entire Tzibur at least should have a higher standard. If everybody in that shul was wearing shorts and sandals and a t-shirt, so whether one thinks that's a good idea or not, you know, you're not going to complain if the Shliach Tzibur is perfect representative of the Tzibur.
Rabbi, what about why not take off the shoes and why not be even barefoot if Moshe Rabbeinu has to do that in a holy place. If, I don't know what the Kohen Gadol does when he goes in.
A young man who happens to be a student of mine literally just asked me this question the other day about being in the Beis Medrash, you know, without, he's talking about not wearing his shoes in the Beis Medrash. I told him the Beis Medrash is perfectly fine. When you're not, then you're supposed to put your shoes on. So he asked me, well, what about, it's a good question, what about, so I think, you know, it is an interesting question. I didn't look up the answer to it. I mean, I told him, we know that that's not the case. Why that is so, I don't know. In other words, I would be tempted to say in the biblical period that was a sign of respect, except that, today it's clearly not the way we see things. But if you go up on Harabias, I've never gone on Harabias, but I think you're supposed to take off your shoes when you go up on Harabias.
And when the Kohanim is open.
When the Kohanim is open, right. So.
I only speak for Hungarians, but in a Hungarian household, you take off your shoes when you come in.
Correct. But they also, you know, put plastic, you know, on the couch. Yeah. Right. For anything. And I'm half Hungarian, so I can say
that.
Okay.
So. Is there an issue of a mourner? Isn't it also mourners?
So, you know, I mean, some people don't like the idea.
Yeah.
Right. I don't think that's a din. I think we have lots
with socks or without socks.
I guess you could take your, if you took your socks off, and then you wouldn't like the other. I don't think that's a din. You know, I think when you walk into a Beis Avel, I hope in real Hungarian houses, they don't expect to take off their shoes and walk in Beis Avel. But, I don't think that's a din. So I think norms change. I don't know how to explain the fact that certain ones remain fixed in place. I mean, there is one element, but this doesn't explain everything. It explains the Kohanim are not allowed to wear shoes because you can't have a chatzitza between them, their body and the floor of the Azara. Right? They could have a bandage on the bottom of their foot because the Kohanim's feet have to be on the floor of the Azara. Because it's makudash, it's like a clay, like when they hold a kli sharis, when they hold a vessel for ministering, you can't have something on your hand that's a chatzitza. Mm-hmm. So too, they can't have chatzitza between their feet and the holy ground of the Azara. But that doesn't explain other people.
What about socks? Yeah, that doesn't explain.
They can't. What do you mean? Why Kohanim wear socks? So I don't know. I don't know why they wear socks. It's a good question.
They
probably don't want to take off socks. It's true. But nonetheless, in the Azara, that I have no doubt about. In the Azara, the Kohanim could not have anything between their feet and the ground.
So they couldn't do the avodah if they had a bandage.
Correct. That's discussed in the Mishnayos and the Gemara in Eruvin, and at the end of the Masechta, don't ask why it's in Eruvin, have a whole discussion about Ratia and the Mikdash. When they had a bandage, what they would do. There's two possibilities. One is the possibility of Chatzitza. The other is, even if it weren't for Muslim Chatzitza, there's a question. I don't know if this is accepted of being the youth of Begadim. If it's an extra Begad, a Kohen Hedyot told him that has 4 Begadim on, a Kohen Hedyot 8, a Kohen Gadol 8, that's 8. So I don't think that's the real issue. I think the real issue is Chatzitza. So that's for tefillah purposes. But I think they say, Shalehi Davar Chote Prino Vein Haritzvah.
That the bandage doesn't become like a part of the body.
Correct. Okay. Correct. I think that's a good question. Why the standard rules of Chatzitza don't apply, but I'm pretty sure that they don't.
This seems like a scenario where the, the societal, norms of dressing in a way that would be appropriate to meet the president actually goes against what was the original halachic of not wearing shoes, not wearing socks.
Correct.
That might have been the correct way, and now we've kind of gone.
Right. I don't know that, you know, it's not just me and the president. You wouldn't walk into a business meeting, you know, without shoes on your feet, right?
Although in Saudi Arabia, would you?
In Thailand, you would.
I don't think we call that right or wrong. I think norms do change.
Yeah.
Whether or not, you know, what would a Sanhedrin, I think that Kohanim faced a unique circumstance, but everything else, you know, would that be something that a Sanhedrin would say, well, now it's not a bizayim to walk with shoes, but rather it's bizayim to walk without shoes? I don't know. I have no idea.
Robert, when I met the Pope about 10 years ago, it was going to be a black suit, white shirt, and black tie.
Okay.
And otherwise, I couldn't.
All right. Okay. So,
So the matana here is that agavos are not erva.
it's not clear what the mic, because here's the catch. If I'm not mistaken, in Shulchan Aruch, it might be treated as a suffix. Because the Gemara quotes the Brisa, Zemach Terpana V'Korei, right? And it says, it suggests that Rav Huna is in fact correct. That Agavos seems to be sure. But then the Gemara suggests, Alema Misayele, do we have a proof from this Brisa? And then the Gemara says, no, the Gemara chooses to be Dilchah the proof. In other words, it could have said yes, but it said, no, it's not a proof. So the question now is, do you say the fact that the first Brisa is still stands, and that should serve as a proof? Or do you say, no, now that the Gemara chose at the end of the sugya to say, maybe not, even though it's to a different Brisa, perhaps really the Gemara is not certain about it. As I mentioned before, one could have actually distinguished between these two, a very different argument that there's a difference between physical contact. The way, as Rashi says, what's he saying? No, he doesn't say. Abai says, by ika gavos, the nagi ahadadi, they're touching, it's because they're touching, not because you see it. And one could have, and the raya that they bring, that agavos im shem erba is a situation about seeing, right? When you're exposed and making brachos. So one could have actually made a distinction and said, listen, yes, when you're in, under the sheets, in bed, reading kriyashma, agavos are not a problem. But perhaps, sight line would in fact be an issue. I looked this up last week. I thought it's not clear from the Shulchan Aruch how we were. I think it's a suffix. Okay. Next. Amar Mar, as we've probably mentioned a few times, means when the Gemara quoted a longer braisa earlier, it quoted it for whatever purpose, and now the Gemara wants to go back and analyze another piece. So it's basically saying, okay, we quoted it. There's a piece of what we quoted above. Amar Mar. So the Brisa said that if a person is sleeping under the covers with his young children, then the physical contact is not a problem. You don't need to be master panav, because the assumption is that there's no hiver. That person is not going to have distracting thoughts while reading Kriya Shema because under normal circumstances, people aren't sexually attracted to children and certainly not their own children. So, ad kam, the Gemara says, until what age? Because at a certain age, it's inappropriate. So, Amar Rav Chista gives one opinion, which is, Tinokas pashalo shana v'yom echad, v'tinok ben tesha shana v'yom echad. Rav Chista says 3 years and a day for a girl, 9 years and a day for a boy. Now, this is a very interesting choice on Rav Chista's part. We recognize what these ages are. These are the ages at which an act of sexual intercourse is considered intercourse, is considered via. It's not that physically one can't have penetration before these ages, but the penetration before these ages of halacha is not considered bia for technical purposes. There are a whole series of ramifications. Not important right now, but nonetheless, so it seems that Rav Chista is picking an age at which we would say bia is impossible. Now that doesn't seem on the surface to necessarily be the most compelling choice, because the concern here is not one of via. Right? If the concern were one of via, then you would say it's prohibited to be under the covers, period, reading Kriya Shema or not reading Kriya Shema. Which might explain why the next opinion in the Gemara, which is Ika da Amre, and I believe this is the accepted opinion, Tinokes Basur Aleph Shana V'Yomechad, the Tinok Ben Shem Esrei Shana V'Yomechad. For Chazal, at least, this is a year before they reach a boy and a girl reach the age of Gadlus, Bar or Bat Mitzvah. The assumption is it's a year before puberty typically has already arrived. Edi says the Gemara, Ad Kdei Shadayim Nachonu Usarech Tzimea. The verse happens to be a citation from Yechezkel, describing the Jewish people as a young woman in Egypt, where literally Shadayim Nachonu means the breasts have come in, and the hair has sprouted, referring to pubic hair. It means physical maturity. So basically what the Gemara is saying here, the second opinion of Rav Chista, is once the child has already begun puberty, then it's no longer, it's prohibited to read Kriya Shema, because even if we're not concerned apparently about inappropriate behavior, it at least would be considered distracting. I think today we would consider it probably entirely inappropriate behavior, period. It would raise warning flags. We do live in a different society. Yes, Larry, that is possibly correct. I mean, it would be a very bad practice. But the Gemara here is talking about at least the minimum halacha, So for Kriya Shema at that age already, it's prohibited. Okay, so now the Gemara comes back to the original question, which Shmuel had been engaged in a dispute, which is the Braisa has stated that two people sleeping under the same sheet or cover or blanket can turn back to back and can read Kriya Shema. And the Gemara had two opinions. Was this by, the first opinion was, of Shmuel, who said that two strangers can do this, and even the husband and wife can do it. Two strangers means two strangers of the same sex. And even a husband and wife is okay. And then the Gemara said, what do you mean? A husband and wife should be more okay than two strangers. A husband and wife, we're not concerned about this. In other words, he's used to this. It's not distracting. So the Gemara wants to know what was the halacha. The Gemara says, Amar le Rav Kahana Rav Ashi. Hasam, in the first case, when we dealt with the question of what should a man do with his tefillin in his one-room house by his bed when his wife is with him and they'll be engaged in sexual intercourse, what should he do with his tefillin? So Shmuel said something there. The Gemara quoted a braisa to disprove it, and then the Gemara said, but we passed in that way anyway. So we said, Hasam Amar Rava Afal Gad Bitsufta de Shmuel, even though there was a braisa that rejected Shmuel, nonetheless, Tuchasa Kivasei de Shmuel. The halacha is like Shmuel. Hachamai, what would the din be in this case? In other words, in Shmuel's debate here with Rav Yosef as to which is more likely to be permitted, two strangers or husband and wife. So Shmuel said, even a husband and wife, meaning that's both, but that's a bigger fetish, a bigger novel form. So here, how do we pass? So Amar Lei, he responds, Ravashi responds, Atu kula b'chada machta machtinu? What, you paint with a broad brush? Everybody gets swept with the same brush? Just because I tell you in one case, that doesn't mean we always pass in like Shmuel. Atu, elahecha de itmar itmar, mehecha de itmar, lo itmar, lo itmar. So where we say that we're willing to pass in like Shmuel against the particular braisa, so then we do. Otherwise, we don't. And then a very odd gemara, Amalei Rav Mari the Rav Papa. Seyar yotze de digno, mahu. Suppose that you have a person where their erva, their genitalia are covered up, their clothing, but somehow hair is protruding, like the garment, let's say, is not every garment, you can sometimes have garments, and there are hair shirts even, where the hair pokes through. Is that a problem of erva? When the actual body is covered, the flesh is covered, but hair is sticking through. So he responds, karalea, seyar seyar, which means, big deal, seyar. Okay, so apparently that's not a problem.
Mabakach.
Yeah, I mean, it's an odd way of saying mabakach. But yeah, I mean, that's the right way of saying mabakach. Okay, fine. Now, I'm Rav Yitzchak. And here, I should introduce this with a sort of a general point, which I say this not because of the crowd here in particular, because there's a lot of confusion in the Orthodox world over two different terms. I probably mentioned this before. There's one term which is erva, and there's another term which is tzniz. And these two, because they do sometimes overlap in certain ways, often get confused with one another. Tzniz applies to everything in life, including covering one's body. It applies, fundamentally speaking, to men and women equally, in pretty much every arena in life. That's tzniz. That's a concept that seems to have been lost by most of our world. Orthodox, not Orthodox, ultra-Orthodox, Jewish, not Jewish. There doesn't seem to be so much of a concept of tzniz left in our culture. But it applies to everything, including what parts of the body covering one's body appropriately. A better way to put it. Erva is a technical halachic category. It refers to parts of the body, when uncovered, have ramifications for various things. Can you recite Dvarim Shevikdusha, like brachos, when you're uncovered or when you see someone who's uncovered? Can you say Kriya Shema? Can you daven? And are you allowed to have it revealed, even walking around? Now, it's in this context that there is a distinction that's drawn between men and women. I'm not going to engage in apologetics here. There might be obvious reasons for that, obvious reasons why it's very logical, and obvious reasons one would argue that it reflects also a particular worldview. I'm not going to enter into that ticket. Suffice it to say, I'm just going to treat the halacha as it's presented. So the concern, as we mentioned before, there are two considerations. There's erva between a person with him or herself or with someone of the same sex. And then there's erva of a man in the presence of a woman who has some part of her body uncovered. That would normally be covered. So the Gemara says the following. Amar Rav Yitzchak, tefach be'isha erva. It says one hand rest in a woman, presumably uncovered, is considered erva. So the Rishonim all say, this means a part of the body that is normally covered.
Is that a social construct?
What's that?
Is that a social construct? In other words, some parts of the bodies in some communities are acceptable to be uncovered.
That's what I mentioned before. I think that that's very, very clear. I'll talk about that. Well, let me use the example. We're going to read it a few lines just to sort of illustrate that point. Shok be'isha erva. What is a shok? It's usually mistranslated. 9 out of 10 people would probably give me the wrong answer. What does the shok refer to? When you say that shok in a woman is erva, which part of the body is the shok? Right. So that is not what the word shok means. That's usually what people translated it. I suspect that's under the influence of contemporary society, where most of our society and a good part of the Orthodox world, a woman's calf is not considered erva. So when the Gemara says shok be'isha erva, we assume obviously it's the thigh, because in our society, we understand, even every part of society understands the thigh already, some part of the thigh already is something that would typically be covered. The word shok refers to, sorry, the Zoom, you can't see it, the bone between the knee and the ankle. If you're not convinced of that, you can look at the biblical expression, mishoch ad yorech. The yerech is the thigh. You also can look at the anatomy of the body as listed in the opening chapter of Maseches Ahalos, the bones in the human body, and it's quite clear again that the shok refers to the bone between the knee and the ankle. Rabbi Kelvin.
You know any butcher in Israel, and the shok is the drumstick, and the yerech is the thigh.
Okay. So,
drumstick is the, you know, yeah.
Would be the analog of the, whatever you call the calf bone. What's the calf bone? So I think there's only one.
Tibia
and fibula are the bones in the calf. And so that is what's considered choke. Now, there is a reason why in some Haredi circles, many Haredi circles, they're machbid that even the women, the married women certainly, and even the girls, wear hose or something that covers their entire calf. You know, even though the skirt doesn't cover it, because it's covered over. Because shok be'isha erva. It's very clear that there are a lot of firm Jews who assume minimally, you have to make one of two assumptions. You either assume that the entire category is subjective, that any part that's normally uncovered is not erva, shok was erva in the time of the Gemara, or you have to say the entire shok would be considered erva, but if part of it is covered, it's not. I think that interpretation is wrong. I don't know if anybody actually writes that. I don't think that makes any sense in this context. I think when you make the analogy to Sayar, it means the hair is, well, the Gemara will say hair is erva unless it's normally uncovered. Shok is erva unless it's normally uncovered. It's not that there's a din, you have to have, you know, something below the knee. I have a story also that was told to me, and please do not misunderstand the story as a approbation or a commendation of miniskirts, but apparently I was told by Rav Aaron Soloveitchik Zal, his nephew by my marriage, told me this many, many years ago. He's the Rebbe of the shul on which I grew up, that when the miniskirts first came out, so there were a number of Rabbanim who wanted to sign a proclamation that was an Issa Daraisa. And Rav Aaron Soloveitchik refused to sign it because he said if that's what they're wearing, so then that may not be, the way it was told to me, that may not be considered erva. Rav Aaron was not expressing his approval for the new fashion, but the point remains intact is that erva is determined outside of what I would say objective erva is heavily dependent upon societal norms. It's for that reason that we will see, probably not today, that despite the fact that almost all poskim assume that married women still have to cover their hair, and the Aruch HaShulchan and Rav Moshe Feinstein certainly did, nonetheless, they say that for the purposes of erva, meaning read Kriya Shema, you know, when the hair is uncovered, it's not erva. Okay, now, so anyway, so the Gemara now says, what does this mean, tapach v'isha erva? Lamai, what was the context? Ilema le'istakule ba. If it means to gaze at it, and gaze at it means for the intent of deriving pleasure, v'ha'am Rav Shesha. Rav Shesha said, lama mana ha'kasuv tashitin shebachutz im tashitin shebefnit. The Gemara in Shabbos, it talks about when the soldiers, the Jewish soldiers in Sefer Bamidbar, chapter 31, came back from the war with the Midianites, and they had captured all this jewelry, right? And they bring it as an offering to God. They come to Moshe Elazar, and Moshe Elazar takes this gold jewelry, presumably to melt it down, and they list all the kinds of jewelry they found. It's presumably mostly from the women. And in that list, the Gemara says, are jewelry that is exposed and jewelry that's actually worn under the clothing. Why? I'm not going to go into why that might have been, but that's what the Gemara assumes. So why does the Torah put this list together? That's what the Gemara says. To teach us that kolamistakel b'lomar l'ha, kolamistakel b'etzba katana shal isha, which probably means a married woman, one who gazes at any part of her with the purpose of deriving, let's say, sexual pleasure, ilu mistakel b'makom hator. This is looking at her private parts. Pretty strong statement. Erva, okay, so that can't be, so we're not talking about, tefach b'isha erva does not have anything to do with, with another woman. Now, the halacha would be that maybe another woman, aside from one's wife. The Gemara is going to say it has something to do with Kriya Shema and one's own wife. What we would normally say, well, let me read on a little bit first. The Ela b'ishta ula Kriya Shema. So what this means is the following. If a man's wife is reading Kriya Shema, presumably he's sitting at home, and this would probably apply to making brachos as well, and his wife happens to be there, and she's dressed in a way which might be perfectly appropriate at home, but what uncovering things that normally would be covered, certainly she went out in public. So if there's a tefach or more uncovered, he's not allowed to read Kriya Shema in her presence. Now, there's a debate about this issue. What about if it wasn't his wife? How do the same rule apply? The Rush and the Ramah closest in Shulchan Aruch, I think it's on the Xerox, which we're not going to get to today, so thanks for all that effort. This morning I'm trying to post the sources. The Rush assumes that it makes no difference. In other words, even if it's not his wife, if it's a tefach or more that's normally covered, then you cannot read Kriya Shema, you cannot recite Devarim Shebisusha. But if it's less than a tefach, it doesn't matter whether it's his wife or someone else. If he just happens to be there, that's not a problem for you reading Kriya Shema.
It obviously has to be in front of
him. It has something he would see. Yeah, be in front of him. If it's behind you, it's not a problem. Right. So that's the first thing. That is the explanation of Rav Yitzchak's statement. Amar Rav Chista now says, Shok v'isha erva. So Shok, Tibia and Tibula. Shenemar gali shok ivri naharos, uchsil tigal erva se. One of the Nevi'im, Yeshaya is telling one of the, is telling someone who's going to go into exile, crossing rivers, gali shok, and then later it says, tigal erva sech. By doing so, you have uncovered your erva. Now, shot might not be this way. The simple interpretation might be that when as most people, not just women, weren't wearing underwear, then if you go through a river, I don't know if I've ever told this, it's one of the strangest shilas I ever got. It's not a school that asked me questions. So the principal called to talk to me about an issue. Apparently, the teacher had been told the students that, you know, like that when a girl, when she's using the laundry machine, her boys are not allowed to be. Yeah, I think that was the question was, what? Right, that's the right question. So it took me a second to figure out where the Rebbe had crossed lines, which was the Gemara speaks harshly. I think where the Gemara is at, someone who looks at a woman, who gazes at a woman, b'shah she'omdos ala tfisa, when they're engaged in doing laundry. You have to say, how did they do laundry? They didn't have a Maytag machine. They went to the river. But if you want to go do laundry, well, you don't want your skirt to get wet. So what you do is you lift up your skirt. And that's how people are not typically wearing underwear. They're not even a loincloth. And that's why it's exceedingly inappropriate. So that's what's being described there. Just like when you do laundry, so to when you cross a river, again, you would, like if you go hiking and you have to cross a river, you know, and if you're wearing water shoes, you roll your pants up so that your pants don't get wet. So that's what's being described here. So there, but because it says that Dali Shok, therefore the Shok is not smachta in this regard. The real reason why Shok would be considered erva is because it's normally covered. Okay. Then, Amar Shmuel, and this is going to be the controversial one, Kol B'Isha Erva. A woman's voice is considered erva, and the assumption of the Rishonim is it has to be someone who is an erva, which would either be a married woman or a single woman who happens to be a niga. So in those cases, it would be considered an erva. Shenemar ki koleich arev umareich noveh. Quoting the pasuk from Shir HaShir, that God is describing the allegory, I guess, of the man and woman, describes a koleich arev. Your voice is beautiful. So therefore it's attractive and therefore it's considered erva. And finally, we'll talk about this more in a second. Amar of Shesha, Seir B'Isha Erva, Shenemar, from the same verse, Sarech Eder Ha'izim. Okay, from Shir HaShir. Okay. Now, the truth is, I think that these psukim all have to be understood in a certain way as asma, for a very, very simple reason. If these are to be taken literally, that everything that the doze in Shir HaShirim described as being beautiful as an erva, then a woman's eyes are an erva. Everything is an erva, right? The dode describes everything of the raya, every part of her, you know, as being beautiful. So obviously I think the Gemara is using the psukim just as a support, but describing what was considered normal in their context. The big, I'll call it halakha controversy, and on some level it is a controversy, is how to, we have to first talk about in what context the Gemara meant these statements, but the truth is everybody agrees that these statements apply generally outside of Kriyat Shema. There is a dispute amongst the Rishonim whether or not Kol, or maybe even Seyar, is considered Erva, certainly Kol, during Kriyat Shema. Let's say you sing Kriyat Shema and you hear some woman singing. So, do you have to stop reading Kriyat Shema, or can you just keep doing your thing? That's a machlokes. Everybody does agree that these categories of Shok and Seyar and Kol have application outside of Kriyat Shema, meaning, generally speaking, what is considered an appropriate dress for a woman in public. Now, the challenge to this, the problem with this is, how does one apply this in a society where norms have changed? You might have noticed that I've already kind of danced delicately around the question, I don't mean delicately from a political perspective, delicately from a textual and conceptual perspective, around the issue of women's hair covering. It's pretty clear in our community, in our society, women's hair is not considered hair. And yet, the overwhelming majority of postings, there is a small minority of exception, but the overwhelming majority of postings say that a married woman has to cover her hair. How much hair? That's maybe a different question. It may be that one's hair is not erva. Maybe any hair covering is sufficient, and it doesn't matter how much hair sticks out, but some kind of covering of the hair. Even as best as I understand, Rav Soloveitchik, whose wife did not cover her hair, did not tell people that it wasn't necessary. So the question is, how do you keep those two together? How is it possible to say that a married woman must cover her hair, but at the same time, hair is not considered erva? The very logical conclusion, which is, again, as I said, almost no post, there are few relatively minor poskim in the last century, in the last 100 years, who've made such an argument. But how, you know, it's a fairly logical jump is to say, well, if there's not the erva anymore, then why should you have to cover your hair? A similar thing takes place with the issue of kol, not in the modern sense, which, you know, has its own question, but what type of kol, b'isha, is considered an erva? The Gemara does not say anything about what kind of sound or what kind of speech it is. And there is, in fact, a Gemara in Kiddushin. There's a story, a fascinating story in its own right.
This is a subject of Saul Berman's article in the Bali Counter of Rabbi Yosef Lipsky.
Okay. So there's a story that takes place between Rav Nachman and Rav Yehuda, where the short version of the story is Rav Nachman summons Rav Yehuda to a din Torah because somebody was Tovea, somebody had a complaint. So Rav Nachman sent a hazmana to Rav Yehuda. Rav Yehuda didn't take kindly to it. The Gemara is in Kiddushin, I think that's Ayin Aleph. And he didn't take kindly to it, but he went. His advice that he was given was just go, even though Rav Yehuda was a bigger Talmud Chacham, but Rav Nachman was the Chassan of the, he was the son-in-law of the Exilarch, and he was the Dayan, so you just have to go. And in the process, at least initially, Rav Yehuda is verbally shredding Rav Nachman. Not before they get to a Din Torah. He's just greeting, throwing to Rav Nachman, he's doing everything wrong. Not even nothing to do with this law. He's busy mowing his lawn. It's not appropriate for Nachman to mow his lawn. He speaks in a language, a dialect that's not appropriate for Talmud Chacham. And then Rav Nachman says to him, should I send greetings to Yalta, to my wife from you? And Rabbi Yehuda, in the context, there are two parts to the statement. He says, kol b'isha erva, which means that Rabbi Yalta might respond and say something to Rabbi Yehuda, and that would be inappropriate for Rabbi Yehuda to hear Rabbi Yalta, you know, greeting. Speaking. Yeah, it might be a greeting, Shela Shalom, but it's speaking, it's not singing.
Cool.
So if you were to take that Gemara at face value, and it would seem to be the case, it's not just that you can't, I know the modern issue always comes up with singing, but it sounds like from the Gemara that any kind of speech would be prohibited. Now, what we will see, we're not going to get to it today, I guess, we will see is that already, almost, the Rishonim, I think, it already starts with, and you see in the Shulchan Aruch, all of a sudden it becomes Kol Zemer. It becomes singing. Now, I can understand why singing is more problematic than speaking. I do get it. But it certainly raises a legitimate avenue of inquiry, which I'm not going to go down. I'm presenting it just because we're passing it. I'm choosing not to wade into the political controversy. But it does open legitimate avenues of inquiry whether or not Kol Ba'isha is very much subjective. I think there is no doubt that there are some kind of singing today that would be considered mostly totally inappropriate. It has to do often with both the content of the songs and perhaps the way the singer sings it. But the question is, does that mean that all Kol Zemer of an Isha has to be considered Erev Bizman Hazan? So I'm not going to go into that explore that any further, but certainly there are some elements. When it comes to Seir, for example, both Kol historically and Seir for sure, Seir, there's certainly much more evidence there, starting with the Rishonim already, that hair that is typically uncovered is A, not a problem of Erva, and B, seems to be not a problem at all. The example that Rishonim will talk about, we'll see, probably take a look at briefly next week, is the hair that normally comes out from underneath their head cover, which implies some hair comes out from under the head covering. That's not a problem of Kriyashma. That's not a problem of anything. So, and there seems to be no opprobrium attached to that. In fact, that some hair sticks out, some posting might, many will post might explicitly. So whatever these laws apply, Seir and Kol, there is at least some degree of societal subjectivity.
Okay. Rabbi, what's the evidence that this applies outside of the context of the Varnish of the Kedusha? I mean, you mentioned the Gemara and Kedusha, which seems to be that way, but...
Right, so that's the Kol B'Isha Erva.
But any of these categories, it all seems to be in the context of Kriyat Shema.
So, but Kol there is not, and Seir is not, well, we're going to look at the text of Mishnah Sibba. And so that's certainly not in the context of Kriyat Shema, either, Zarn Shema Kedusha. That's just in the object of covering. What's striking is that, again, I think it's the position of the Gonim, I think it's the Rift position, who omits the entire discussion here. He doesn't quote any of this. Is the Rift thinks that this has nothing to do with Kriyat Shema. The Rift will say, if you happen to see one chair uncovered, or you hear someone singing, it's like it's too much of a burden. So if you can concentrate, you can just ignore it and read. So yes, looking at the Gemara here, you would have thought, and I think the reason why the Rift will read that way is because after the Gemara says, the Gemara doesn't use the term, it is hard to explain. The obvious interpretation would have been here, but you have at least Kol and Seir are explicitly discussed elsewhere, not in the context of the Baruch Shem. So you could ask, what about Shoch? But I think once you're reading especially if you're going to read the latter two, is it the latter two? Seir, yes, Seir and Kol, as having nothing to do with Kriya Shema, or not limited to Kriya Shema, then Shof won't be limited to Kriya Shema either.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, any questions?
So this is for next week.
Yes, the source sheets will be for next week. I'll collect, yeah. If you want, take, otherwise I'll collect the remainder and bring them back.
Tomorrow,
what's that?
No. Huh? All right.